from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Tell me what you want, what you like, it's okay. I'm a little curious, too.
We all know the big pop hits, the ones that get stuck in your head, that you know the words to, the hook, years after they peak. Maybe Demi Lovato or Taylor Swift or Katy Perry or Rihanna or the Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears. What's not so well known is how these big hits are made and who's creating them, the architects of pop music today, and how they do it year after year. This hour on Point, stepping into the song machine, into the world of producers, beats, and algorithms where the hits are made. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know the machinery behind the hits? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is John Seabrook, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the terrific new book, The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. John Seabrook, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
This is a great piece of work, sir. I didn't know just how fascinating this would be. I guess we all knew that these days you just listen to the songs, and it's clear they didn't just come out of somebody's little notebook in the middle of the night sitting with a guitar on the back porch. But you describe this unbelievable machinery behind the song we're hearing right here and so many others. Give us a sense of the portion of big hits on the radio right now and over the last, I don't know, decade and more that came out of Stockholm, I guess.
The statistic I have heard is that 25% of all top 10 Billboard hits in 2014 were co-produced or co-written by Swedes, which when you think about the fact that Sweden has less than 10 million people in it, is a kind of remarkable statistic.
I mean, it's not only Swedes, but you paint this picture of kind of 40-something Swedish guys and some Norwegians and some Americans in there as well, with their finger on the pulse of some great algorithms and software and a sort of formula for hit-making. They may be very far from wherever Taylor Swift and Rihanna are hanging out, but they're doing this. Introduce us to just one, Max Martin, to get a sense of how all this works.
And Max Martin, who is a Swede, has written 21 Billboard number one hits, beginning with Britney Spears' Hit Me Baby One More Time, and the last one was The Weeknd's I Can't Feel My Face.
21. So I mean, only like McCartney and Lennon have more than him.
That's right. And they didn't last as long as Max Martin. So that's a really remarkable fact. And why did it happen, and why is it a Swede? I think there are a lot of reasons, but I think two reasons maybe I could just point to quickly. One is that I think we grow up in this world of R&B on one side and pop on the other side, and those distinctions come from racial categories that go far back into our history, and they tend to block white people from writing R&B, certainly. In Sweden, they don't really exist. At least the racial legacy of those distinctions don't exist. And so I think that Swedes are more comfortable working in a genre that most people would call R&B. And I think the impact of Max Martin and his colleagues has been to combine pop and R&B in a way that Americans couldn't do it and give us back this kind of rhythmic pop or sort of dance pop, which is now what dominates the airwaves. That's one thing. And quickly, I'll just say the other. I think a lack of English actually works to their advantage. They speak English. Mm-hmm. Of course, Swedes are very good at speaking English, but they don't use a lot of fine points of English, double entendre, metaphor, wit, which are staples of songwriting going far back into Tin Pan Alley. And because of that, I think they're able to listen to the syllables of the words and match them with the sounds, and that just adds to the hook.
Whether it all really, really makes sense in a subtle way, not nearly as important as the power of the hook. Well, look at what makes that. I mean, you think about the song. I mean, Taylor Swift, just from Max Martin, that's where we got Shake It Off. That's where we got Blank Space. That's where we got Bad Blood. That's where we got We're Never Getting Back Together. And then Katy Perry, just song after song, like Teenage Dream and a whole lot more, all the way back to Britney Spears' Baby One More Time, Katy Perry, I Kissed a Girl, all these from one guy. I mean, their names are on them also, but what's the role of the artist actually very often in the creation of these, the performing artist in the creation of these songs, John?
Well, it changes from artist to artist, of course. I think Taylor Swift is probably a lot more involved than some of the artists, other artists you mentioned. And certainly on the lyric side, I think Taylor is very involved because, again, lyrics aren't what Max Martin does. What Max Martin does is really the hook, and the hook and the role that the hook plays in the song and the number of hooks in a song is one thing that's really changed a lot. You need a hook every 7 seconds, according to Jay Brown, who I spoke to, who's an executive at Def Jam, live Rock Nation now. You need a hook every 7 seconds because people change the radio station every 7 seconds if they don't like what they're hearing. And so that has created this new approach to songwriting where you first make a track and then you just try to stud it with as many hooks as you can. And what Max Martin is so gifted at is coming up with those hooks. And so even though he didn't write all of those songs that you mentioned, he wrote the hooks in those songs.
Define a hook, John.
A hook is a melodic phrase. It's not even really a melody. It's a very short melody. And this is another thing that I think has changed over the years in terms of popular songwriting. If you go back to Burt Bacharach and Hal David, those melodies tend to flow from verse to chorus. And throughout the whole song, you can kind of say, here's the single melody. Whereas I think in today's pop songs, you have a lot of short melodies that are kind of stacked on top of each other, but don't necessarily link melodically. They're linked rather by the production effects, which are, because of the role of the computer, which is the big song machine here, the effects are what you have at your fingertips as a producer is far greater than you would have had back in the 60s or 70s. And that's kind of what holds the song together. And so you can let the hooks just catch your attention for a couple seconds, and then you can go back to letting the production do the work.
Of course, you've got American producers in here doing this as well, but so much has gone back to Sweden. Here's a little bit from all the way back in 1993, early in this particular chapter. The Sign, Ace of Base, Swedish band, and the big guy behind it, Dennis Popp. Dennis Popp, sort of godfather of Max Martin. Max Martin, then Obi-Wan Kenobi to the Luke Skywalker, you write, of Dr. Luke and a whole lot more. What are we hearing right here, John?
Yeah, this is Ace of Base, The Sign. And my book begins with Ace of Base. It actually begins on the day that an unsolicited demo arrives at the office of Dennis Popp for the song All That She Wants, which was the hit before mm-hmm. The Sign. Mm-hmm. And what Ace of Base did was it put this guy, Dennis Popp, who was a Swedish DJ, who was ambitious to write songs for American and UK artists, it put him on the map. And because of the success of Ace of Base, he was given the opportunity to work with an unknown boy band that was called the Backstreet Boys at the time. And that was also the beginning of Max Martin. Max Martin was originally a performer with a band called It's Alive and signed a record contract with Dennis Popp as an artist. But Dennis Popp quickly realized that Max Martin's real vocation was in songwriting, and he became a part of this studio, which was called Sheyran. And his first huge hits were the Backstreet Boys hits, and perhaps the greatest of those was I Want It That Way, which was a Max Martin melody.
We'll hear that one. Britney Spears, Right in There in a Hurry, too, kind of picked up out of the Mickey Mouse Club. Justin Timberlake there also. And Baby One More Time, also from written and produced by Max Martin, Swedish guy. Massive single, 1999, went to number one in every single country where it charted. And here's Max Martin behind this one.
A couple of interesting things about that, Tom. One is that Max Martin actually wrote it for a black group, TLC, the yeah. American R&B group, and they rejected it because it sounded too white. And the other interesting thing there is the hook, Hit Me Baby One More Time, mm-hmm. I don't think would ever have been written by an native English-speaking songwriter because it sounds like, you know, like a domestic violence or mm-hmm. S&M type thing. And really, all Max was trying to do was, you know, use the latest lingo for, you know, call me up. And in fact, when Jive got the song, Jive was the label that Britney Spears was on, they actually changed the title of the song to dot, 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 Baby One More Time.
Leave out
the hit.
Even though
they couldn't change the hook. Right.
And you could leave that out, but it was just a gigantic hit, giving our listeners a sense of just how widespread the influence of what John Siebert calls the song machine is. And then you say, the Backstreet Boys, of course, 1999, Millennium, huge. And we're going to hear in just a second, I Want It That Way. Max Martin in on that as well with Andreas Carlson. It seems like his fingers, his sound, has been everywhere for a long time now.
Well, I think it's significant that both Britney and the Backstreet Boys came at a time when the music business was at its peak, its historic peak in terms of record sales. Millennium was a record-breaking album that was only eclipsed by NSYNC's album, which Max Martin also wrote. And so I think that helps explain why these people are around today. It's because, you know, these are the golden days for the music business, and maybe if you can use the same people that wrote the songs, you can somehow bring back those golden days.
So the Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, Kelly Clarkson, Pink, Maroon 5, Katy Perry, Taylor Swift, Max Martin, Swedish, producer, songwriter, hook maker, behind all of those. If you thought you noticed some similarities somehow, John Seabrook tells the whole story of how it happens. His new book is The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. You can join us this hour. Did you think Taylor Swift still wrote all her own songs? Can you picture a bunch of old Swedes and Norwegians huddled in Stockholm putting them together? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. John Seabrook, please stand by in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the invisible, largely, squad of producers, Swedes, and software that creates the hits we hear today. Not Taylor Swift or Rihanna or Katy Perry by any means alone, but the crew behind them really manufacturing the sound. My guest is John Seabrook. He's staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the terrific new book, The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us this hour. What do you think? When we celebrate Swift, Rihanna, Nicki Minaj, Britney Spears, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, should we be celebrating Martin Sandberg, Tor Hermansen, Lucas Gottwald? Have you noticed how many of the hits sound kind of similar? Now do you see why? What do you think of this way of making music? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Behind us, On My Mind by Ellie Goulding, and Max Martin, who we've been talking about, is a co-writer and co-producer on this song. This one's brand new, just out September 17th, but given the record of these guys, wouldn't be surprising if it goes pretty well on the charts sooner or later. So John Seabrook joins us from New York. John, if we blindfolded you and put this song on, would you recognize it as coming out of the world that you're writing about?
In the sense that it was made by this technique of songmaking that I call track and hook, which perhaps we should just talk about for a second. In the old days, you know, songs were sort of a melody writer and a lyric writer, and they got together over the piano and smoked a pack of cigarettes and banged out a tune. Then the production, the arrangement came, and then the production came. These days, the production comes first. When a producer sitting in front of a computer screen using a program like Pro Tools makes a track, and a track has all of the instrumentation, which is all done electronically, The arrangement is just automatically done by the software, and the rhythm track, the beats, are all done first. Then into the studio comes what they call a top line writer, or a hook writer, if you will, and they listen to a number of different tracks, because it's easy to make a lot of tracks at once, as though you're making dough for donuts, but you don't yet have the glaze on the top of them yet. And the hook writer comes in, listens to a lot of the different tracks, and then says, oh, that one's interesting, goes into the booth and sort of freestyles for a while, and if they're good, and I have one person in the book named Esther Dean who is very good, comes out with a hook. And then it's really just a question of writing some words and moving things around. And it takes a couple of hours, really. And you've got a song. And even though that song might not be a hit, because you can make 25 or 30 songs pretty quickly that way, whereas if you sat around at a piano, it would take a long time, one of those songs is likely to if not be a huge hit, then to be successful. And so really that's how songs are made today.
Esther Dean, another one of this posse, Swedish or Norwegian, I forget.
No, she's American.
American, okay.
She's very American.
Okay, okay, good. So somebody in there.
She is through and through American.
The Norwegians, they go by Stargate. They're in the middle of a lot of these.
Stargate are the producers of a lot of the Rihanna songs. So we've been talking about Katy Perry and Taylor Swift. Max Martin has never actually written a Rihanna song. And it's interesting that even though the Norwegians are also Scandinavians, they grew up listening to hip-hop music and early hip-hop and R&B, whereas Max Martin was listening to glam rock. He was a big Kiss fan when he was a – so he actually, even though they're both from Scandinavia, he actually had an extremely different musical background. And the Stargate guys, these two Norwegian guys, Tor and Mikkel, are able to tap into a hip-hop sound and have been very successful in working for Rihanna. And Esther Dean is kind of Rihanna's go-to hook maker when they're working on a Rihanna song. And she sort of is able to channel Rihanna and sing it out on the mic right there in the booth. And I saw it. I saw it happen. It's magic. She's like a savant of hook writing. It's genius.
And channeling what Rihanna will eventually do with it. I mean, you describe a system in which the tracks and hooks get put together very often before the artist who's going to perform it is even known, though. Then they shop it around. And the better it is, the bigger the artist who's going to snarf it up.
Right, Tom. So the other component here is you have to have a sung demo. You have to have someone sing what's called the trace vocal. And the trace vocal is essentially what it sounds. It's the vocal that the artist is actually going to follow when they record the song. And what's interesting about Max Martin is that Max Martin actually sings the vocal on the demos himself. Max Martin is a
good
brilliant singer.
Yeah.
So it's incredible that this guy can write these incredible songs, and he could actually have recorded them as an artist and sung them, in which case we would be talking about him in the same context as the Beatles, as a performer maybe. But instead, everybody can sing a Max Martin song, but no one has ever heard the original Max Martin demos. I actually did hear one on someone's phone for the Britney Hit Me Baby, and it sounded exactly like Britney. exactly like Britney.
Which means that Britney was channeling him when she sang that song.
Totally.
And it wasn't just
that happens.
Not just way back when. Bad Blood, Taylor Swift, very big, much more recently, this year, written by Max Martin, of course, along with others, Kendrick Lamar and more, but Max Martin right in the middle of the big Taylor Swift hit, Bad Blood. John Seabrook writes up the whole system, the software, the algorithms, the formula, the works in his new book, The Song Machine. It is really a great read. A lot of callers for you, John. From Detroit, Dennis is calling. Dennis, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I hear a lot of influence of ABBA in these songs, and since they're a Swedish group, I'm wondering if the author can comment on Max Martin's possible relationship to ABBA or the influence of ABBA on him.
Yeah, thanks, Dennis.
Great question.
Yeah,
great question. ABBA really got it started because ABBA showed that it was possible for the next generation of Swedes to be Swedish and to be major pop stars in the English-speaking world. I think without ABBA, I don't think there would have been the inspiration for Dennis Pop to do what he did, and then there wouldn't have been any Max Martin. Also, I would say that the studio candy, the ear candy that ABBA put into its songs is very important in terms of the Max Martin sound, because every single part of those songs is just finished to such a high degree of polish in the studio, using a lot of synthetic instruments as well as real instruments. And I think that was also a huge influence on the later generations of Swedes.
ABBA, huge there. Terry in Williamsburg, Virginia. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to comment about the fact that the history of the producer-songwriter goes back a long way, and the construction of music using studio musicians. Phil Spector on the West Coast with the Wrecking Crew, and in New York, a producer named Burt Burns, who brought Afro-Cuban rhythms and hooks into the music that he produced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been going on a long while.
Yeah, Terry, I'm glad you raised that. If I may, John, here's also a comment on the website. Spark Girl writes to us. She says, people are always saying these days, as if pop music from any era was 100% created by the artist. Pop music has always been catchy fluff, often created by someone other than the person singing it. I mean, even the most groups were put together by an outside person or management or company or whatever. What exactly is new, given that quite true history, John?
That's absolutely true. Frank Sinatra didn't write his songs. Billie Holiday didn't write Strange Fruit. You can go on and on. But I think we did have this singer-songwriter era, beginning with the Beatles, where the artists were, at least in the rock era, were expected to have written their own songs. That era ended. But I think that from the label point of view, everyone just loved the marketing potential of the singer-songwriter era. The idea that the singer actually did write the song makes the song just so much more engaging and interesting, and the artist interesting as well,
mm-hmm.
that I think the labels have tried to kind of keep that sort of sense of how songs were created going, even though we've now kind of definitely gone back to the sort of pre-rock Brill Building era of, you know, professional songwriters and producers writing the songs.
Well, think for a minute about what comes out of that. The Beatles, Lennon and McCartney, still number one and two, I think, for hit songs.
Right. Yeah.
The sound, the texture, the composition of their songs versus what this system is creating today.
I think you should look at it more in terms of like artist development. What's so interesting about listening to the Beatles hits back to back is you can really sense how they were responding to changes in society in the 60s and growing and pushing back. And you have a whole story there of the 60s. If you listen to Max Martin songs back to back, you don't get that. You don't, where's the cultural envelope? What is it? What story does it tell you about our times or his times? It's really much more of a sort of one-off deal every time he does a song. And it's all about being a hit. That's all it really is about. It's not about saying something about, you know, what's going on around us, which the Beatles really were, to some extent, particularly in their later career, trying to
sure.
do.
And it was very, very audible. Now we get irresistible songs very often, but audible in telling us something about our world and its evolution? I don't know. Here's another one. This is written by Tor Erik Hermansson, Michael Erickson, Epson Lind, Amon Bjorklund, Neo, and Beyoncé. Irreplaceable.
To the left, everything you own in the box to the left. To the left, to the left. Don't you ever for a second get to thinking irreplaceable.
Kind of incredible, 2006, and of course it's Beyoncé behind her, all those Bjorklunds and Ericssons and Hermansons and Linds, straight, in that case, out of Norway. John Seabrook writes it all up in his book, The Song Machine. Emmanuel is calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Emmanuel, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, John. Thank you. Long-time listener and long-time music lover. Always loved really good music. And I am fascinated by a lot of the technology that's being used in music. It is definitely fascinating. But I also kind of feel like it might be leading, or it is leading to somewhat of a just a degradation to really heartfelt, magical tunes, you know, stuff that I grew up with and other people have grown up with, but, you know, put together with 8 tracks. And I know some people that actually do own studios, and they actually are reintroducing 8-track sounds to their modern technology equipment, just to get that feel. So I kind of feel like it's great that there's all this technology, but, you know, music is universal language, and I think you lose a lot of, heart and
that heartfelt sound that comes right through something that's not quite so highly polished. Emmanuel, thanks. Let me get one more on that front, I think, from Detroit again. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. I'm enjoying this conversation quite a bit. I'm a jazz saxophonist, and I earlier heard the comment regarding the number, of hooks or motifs, as we call them in music, of little melodies that are apparently artificially inserted into these songs, and contrast that to a great tune like Alfie, written by Burt Bacharach, where the lyric, the melody, and the harmony all work together in a totality of circumstance to make a magical tune. Now, we as jazz musicians use a lot of little motifs in our playing as well, mm-hmm. but they're all organically related to each other. When I listen to all this pop music, and I, by the way, I didn't know about this Max fellow who wrote all this stuff, because it absolutely sounds all the same to me. It's totally fascinating to find that there's no apparent progression within these songs from a beginning to a middle to an end for a cohesive whole.
Interesting.
John, is that deliberate? I mean, do they care about a progression?
I think they care about a number one hit, and so if, you know, they have it, then they're not going to worry too much about a progression. You know, the other thing I think we're talking about here that I maybe should make explicit is the other huge change is the change from music made with real instruments to music made with computers, in which the real instruments, quote unquote, are all inside the computer.
Somebody mentioned studio musicians, and you're right that they're not part of this world.
Studio musicians don't really exist. I mean, you know, there's maybe one or two left, and the other guys are all teaching guitar lessons to people like me. That's the way they're making a living.
Yeah.
They're all gone. And again, it's because it's easy, it's fast, it's cheap. You know, you don't have to hire all these people. You don't have to have them sitting around the studio drinking beer, you know. And whether it's better or not is not really the decision that's being made. The decision is, oh, well, we can do this fast. We can do it cheap. We can do it efficiently. Let's do it this way. And therefore, basically all the music you hear on the radio these days is not made with anyone playing an instrument, which is kind of like a mind-boggling thing.
Not ever. Yeah. They're not ever. It's all machine generated sound.
Occasionally, someone will play an instrument into the computer, mm-hmm. you know, and then sort of mess with it, or a keyboard that, you know, sounds like a synth or something. But yeah, no one is putting together a band in the studio and playing the song at the hit level, at the pop top 40 level.
What does that say to you? I suppose you could say computers are just our new instruments, or are we into some new realm here that's a break from the past?
You know, you could say it's democratizing, and it certainly is. It allows a kid sitting in his bedroom with a laptop to call up all the strings from Abbey Road,
yeah,
and you know, put them on, or Hey Jude, and put them on his song in 10 minutes. So, you know, there's something to be said for that. But does it make for, you know, better music? I don't know.
John Seabrook tells a super compelling story in his book about all this, The Sound Machine Inside the Hit Factory. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us this hour. What do you think of this way of making music? Is it really good music, or is it just hard to resist? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Katy Perry here with another, co-written by Max Martin, Swede, and Dr. Luke, and she's got a credit there too, but you get the idea. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Boys and girls, we're unforgettable. Daisy Dukes.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
I came in like a wrecking ball. I never hit so hard in love.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Miley Cyrus with Wrecking Ball behind us right there. And yes, if you really get into the credits, you can track it back to the group of Swedes and more we're talking about today behind so much of today's pop music. Dr. Luke, one of the writers there, described by my guest as Luke Skywalker to the Obi-Wan of Max Martin, Swede, who now is number three for the biggest number of all-time hits, right behind Lennon and McCartney. Listen to Katy Perry, listen to Kelly Clarkson, listen to Britney Spears and Maroon 5 or Taylor Swift and on, NSYNC. And there are his fingerprints. It's a new way in the last 20 years of putting together hit after hit after hit. John Seabrook tells the story in his new book, The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. You can join us this hour. Singers, artists, what do you make of this new way? Are you in on it? Are you shut out by it? Is it fair to call these big pop stars artists when they're just riding a bed somebody else built? Or was it ever thus in some way? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Boy, we get a lot of response online, and it's really interesting. Let's see. What can I give you here? Irene says, talking about the hooks and how many of them there are now. She says, I think the rapidly shifting hooks of today's pop music, a reflection of the ADD nature of how people communicate electronically with cell phones, social media. You can't expect most people to hold an uninterrupted line of attention, John, long enough to listen to a fully developed 3-minute song with unified, coherent, flowing, melodic message. Is this reflecting back to us what we've become, John Seabrook?
It might be. That's as good an explanation as I've heard. The hooks are just proliferating. It's like an arms race, you know, of hooks until I guess we're just going to have all hooks and you know, no progression at all.
29er says the new pop music is unlistenable. Well, I don't know. A lot of people listen to it, but not for this listener. They're not songs. There's no bridge. There's no melody. Just a drum machine with a feral cat meowing over it. At least pop from the 1980s were actual songs, even though he's not a fan.
Not really totally true. I mean, you know, it's interesting with all the changes that we've talked about, The actual basic structure of the song hasn't really changed. You've still got, you know, the verse chorus structure. A lot of them have intros and outros, which are done in the production. And, you know, the number of them do have bridges, including that song Wrecking Ball. There's quite a lovely bridge, actually, in Wrecking Ball. So, you know, the song remains the same as the song goes, but everything else has changed.
Jason writes to us maybe admiringly, or maybe this just is getting closer to our neuro structure. He says, our brains are basically pattern recognition machines, and algorithms can create very intricate patterns indeed. In a funny way, he writes, this is a backdoor gateway to talking about the brain as a computing device. Are these super sophisticated computer-enhanced producers zeroing in on our neuro delights? I don't know.
Totally. Jason's, I think, onto something there. And I think the other key component here is the fact that these songs are repeated so frequently and in so many venues that you virtually cannot not hear them. And it's often the case with me, at least, you know, when I hear it the first time, and this was the case with the song Roar by Katy Perry that I actually heard for the first time in Dr. Luke's studio. He's one of the writers of it. Before it actually came out, he played it for me. And when I heard it, I was thinking, oh, my God, this is terrible. It's so slow and it's boring and this is never going to work. Flash forward a year, it was literally everywhere. Even at my daughter's 6th birthday party, they were singing it. How could I have been so wrong? Or maybe I was right the first time. You know, maybe it's the repetition. And, yeah, it's the brain that loves pattern recognition. It hears that hook. It hears it the first time. Maybe it sort of recoils. But on the third or fourth time, it's happy because it recognizes it. And it even can complete it in your mind just before you hear it. And I think that the brain likes very much.
Sanford in New Orleans. Sanford, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm a professor at Loyola University in New Orleans and have been teaching pop music for several years, and we've just started.
Are you there, Sanford?
I've noticed tend to be wanting to work with music of the 60s and 70s, pre-MIDI, which basically started in the 80s, more than they even want to work with the music of today. It's a very interesting observation I've been making for the last 5-10 years.
Sanford, we lost you for just a second there. And did you say that you see 18 to 22-year-olds moving away from this kind of sound in pop music?
Well, the people I'm working with are actual musicians, guitarists, pianists, singers, songwriters, and they tend to look back into the 60s and 70s with real musicians rather than the electronic sounds that have started since the 80s with MIDI. That is, more or less automating the music that your guest is talking about.
So maybe something of a backlash going on there. Let me hold that thought from New Orleans, if I may, and get one more. John in Nashville, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an indie rock musician in a band of 5 people, and we do a very collaborative songwriting environment, too. But I find it interesting to think about what it is that we're trying to accomplish when compared to pop music. You know, we're certainly not on the same level in terms of audience, but I do think that level from indie success, where you've got a lot of people that are invested in a scene or in a sound or whatever, are interested in what we're doing, but then catching that casual listener becomes more and more difficult as they get used to this sort of, for lack of a better term, high fructose version of music. And I wonder how that affects innovation and just in terms of challenging listeners and finding new sounds and new bands and new things like that.
John, may I ask you, do you feel somehow left out here? I mean, it's obvious that this sound you really can't achieve unless you've got this big factory underneath you. If you don't have access to all that machinery and all that high-priced talent, you're not going to be running, and maybe you don't even want to, but is there an infrastructure that's hard to tap as an independent musician here?
It absolutely is, and it's hard to say because we certainly aren't trying to accomplish anything similar stylistically or even really try for that audience necessarily. I just worry that people get accustomed to hearing this as, oh, that's what good music is, and then that limits what they're even able to go out and find in terms of other sounds and other types of music, because there's so much out there. And I, more even for just myself and my band, I hear so many talented, great musicians, but I feel like get left out in the cold, so to speak, because they can't compete with that level of production and shine that's involved. And I think people don't go that extra step.
We hear it. What do you say, John?
That's an awesome comment. I love high fructose, sounds. I mean, I'm going to use that one. the only other thing I'd say that maybe is a little more hopeful than that comment is there's always a backlash, right? I mean, at least, the history of pop music has been, and Max Martin actually has suffered from a backlash in the late 2000, 2001. There was a very distinct backlash on pop radio stations against the Backstreet Boys and the pure pop sound. And he was actually kind of in the wilderness for a few years. And it wasn't until he hooked up with Dr. Luke and reinvented his sound, and that was Kelly Clarkson, Since You've Been Gone, where he reemerged with an indie rock kind of vibe. I'm sort of waiting for that to happen again. I feel like it's overdue, but if history is any judge, it's going to happen. And, maybe the acoustic instruments and a singer-songwriter kind of a vibe is going to come back.
Evan in Nashville. Nashville's calling today. Evan, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm John. I really think this is an interesting conversation, but I have a couple of points. One is I kind of witnessed all of this from a perspective. I was plugged into a mock boy band that MTV produced back in the heyday, 1999, the Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, and Pink.
Yeah.
And only a couple of us in the band, and I really don't even include myself in that, had much musical talent, so to speak, but we had monster hits, relatively speaking, and a lot of that was in part to a TV show and film that was part of it. But we used all the same producers that the Backstreet Boys, NSYNC,
okay.
did, and they literally plugged us in. Now, my point is, since then, I've moved to Nashville, and I've kind of got dialed into the scene down here from a VJ standpoint, and I see a lot of producers from, you know, we're giving the Swedes a lot of credit, and we had certainly Butt Wren produce, but you've got guys like Ryan Tedder, who, you know, can produce, sing, just like, you know, anybody else, but, you know, what they're doing, they're artists that are creating, you know, art, and in the sense that it's a totally mechanical sound, or it's automated. I take offense to some of that, in that, you know, these guys, they sit there in their studios, and they're creating art just like anybody else, and there's a lot of guys here in the United States, or a lot of artists, men and women, Josh and Brian, mm-hmm. K&S Productions, who are producing all these too, but they're artists as well, and anyway, I just kind of wanted to point that out. It was an interesting thing to be plugged into something without being a, you know, setting out to be a musician, and experience it from a third perspective, really.
Not just Swedes doing all this. Of course, you've got plenty of American producers who are in on this as well. Those are huge sort of scando base to all this that John Seabrook writes up. We're looking at the invisible squad of producers and Swedes and Americans and software creating so many hits today. Dr. Luke, one of those Americans, wrote with Blanco and Kesha, TikTok by Kesha.
I'm talking pedicure on our toes, trying on all our clothes, boys blowing up our phones, dropped up and playing our favorite CDs, pulling up to the parties, trying to get a little bit tipsy.
John Seabrook, our Nashville caller, describes his experience as being plugged into this machinery. You describe how that happens a lot. It feels as though there's been a lot of power taken from at least a certain tier of artists. They're sort of, sometimes they're unknown when they're plugged in here, and off they go.
You know, I certainly agree with him that there is art going on in the studio when it's all done on machines. I mean, if it weren't hard, and if it didn't take creativity and even genius, then a lot more people would be doing it. So I'm not saying that the machines make it bad. I was saying it was a little bit easier maybe on the machines, and that tends to sort of lead to some cutting of corners. The other point I guess I would make here, Tom, is that another huge importance of the Swedes is it's not just that they're Swedes, it's they created a system of mentors and protégés and of group songwriting where different people are assigned to different parts of the song. Some people write the verses, some people write the choruses, some write the bridges, even the outro and the intro. Songs are swapped out, parts of songs are swapped around, and the idea is it's more like writing a TV show. It's a group project, and that approach to songwriting has also been very influential and has spread from Sweden into America through the protégés that the Swedes have taken on. So Dr. Luke learned it from Max Martin. Dr. Luke taught it to Benny Blanco, and now Benny Blanco's out there teaching it to other people. And that's another way of measuring the Swedish influence in pop music today.
Danny in Lexington, Kentucky. Danny, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad that we're talking, actually, about Dr. Luke, and I'm glad you all played some Kesha, because I'm a huge Kesha fan. And one of the things that we're seeing right now in the music industry is we do see a consolidation of power, it looks like. And we're talking a lot about whether or not this is good for music, but we should also be asking if it's good for musicians. Currently, Kesha's in a contract with Dr. Luke and is unable to kind of work with anybody else, but she's also been accusing him of raping her. So she's in a situation where she either makes music and, you know, succeeds, or she has to work with someone who she's, you know, accusing of raping her. And so is that really a good situation for an artist to be in?
I mean, there's a big suit out there right now. You're right on that front, and in which Kesha sort of describes herself as a prisoner of her producer, John Seabrook.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone really knows the act, what really happened, so I'm not going to weigh in on that end. But I will say that also is not entirely unprecedented. If you think about Phil Spector, I mean, he actually married Ronnie, his wife, and kept her in his mansion on Sunset Boulevard, and even had a gold coffin in the basement and said the only way she was leaving was in a box. So, you know, there is this figure of the all sort of controlling producer who bends the artist to his will in history. And Dr. Luke does seem like he fits into that pattern.
Do you think it's running its course, or are we locked in with your song machine for another, I don't know, 10, 20 years or for the future. It's just the way.
Well, I think other forces are also contributing to keep it around. I mean, I think one thing is, you know, the iTunes breaking up of the album and focusing on the single. I mean, an album gives you a lot of leeway to be artistic. You know, some songs are hits, some aren't. But when you're just doing singles and one single after another, there isn't as large a latitude for artistry, and a lot of what makes a single successful or not, at least in the public eye, is whether it's a hit. So I think that aspect tends to move things toward hits. And then the move towards streaming, I mean, I think it's still unclear where it's going, but no one has yet solved the problem of what to listen to next, the discovery portion. And I think because we have all these choices but no idea what to actually choose, a lot of people tend to fall back on top 40 just because, you know, the choice is made for you, and it's easy. It's sort of the default position, and that's what you end up listening to.
You end one of your recent reports with, though, a question about what the songs are about, whether they're about anything beyond the experience of the listening.
I think they're about being hits.
No question about that. Hit after hit after hit. John Seabrook writes it all up in really compelling telling in his new book, The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John, wonderful talking with you today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Really interesting, Tom. Thank you.
A little more from The Weeknd here, Can't Feel My Face. And behind this one, once again, one of the writers, Max Martin. Hey, along with Peter Svensson. And right on. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.